banking system is sound and it's resilient. It's got strong capital and liquidity. We took powerful actions with Treasury and the FDIC, which demonstrate that all depositors' savings are safe and that the banking system is safe. Deposit flows in the banking system have stabilized over the last week.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell today announcing the Fed's decision to raise interest rates by another quarter of a percentage point. It was one of the most closely watched decisions in years. And that's because higher interest rates have been one reason a couple of mid-sized banks collapsed recently. But the Fed says it needs to raise rates to fight inflation. This is the ninth rate increase in roughly a year, and it will not be the last. So what does this move say about the health of the U.S. banking system and also the broader economy? Joining us now is Lynette Lopez, columnist for Business Insider. Welcome back to Press Play, Lynette.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. Okay, this was an important meeting. Lots of people were wondering what the Fed would do. What were the competing pressures on the Fed today?
Well, the raising 25 basis points is kind of like the best outcome. It shows that the Fed still has confidence that it can raise rates in this economy. That is to say, the economy is strong enough to handle a rate increase and that they're not that worried about the stress that we've seen in the banking system, and that the Fed thinks that some of the banks that we saw go under are very special cases of bad management, bad timing, and poor controls. So while, you know, rates going up, it feels uncomfortable, in this instance, it's a good sign for the banking system. The thing is, it also says that the Fed is still concerned about inflation, and the Fed should still be concerned about inflation. Their target is 2%. In February, it came in double that, very hot. So the Fed is saying now, okay, we're going to see what happens with this bank stress, see if that tightens up the economy too. And if it does, then we'll have to do less in terms of ongoing rate increases. So it changed its language a little bit to say, yes, we still know that we need to tighten in the economy, but we're going to wait and see exactly how that happens before we tell you if we're going to do another rate increase going forward.
Okay. So how are we to look at this? Are we, as regular people who are perhaps not invested in these bank stocks and don't have our deposits in these particular mid-sized banks, how should we look at this as an indicator of the broader health of the banking system? Should we be concerned that we could be on the way to another 2008 with the banking system? Or should we be more worried about inflation?
I personally am a little more worried about inflation because it's stickier, it's a global problem, it's more long-term. When I think about the banking system, I think about what we all just went through in the pandemic and how the banks fared. During that period, the banks saw a lot of inflows from people getting checks, from the stock market just rallying and going crazy, crypto, all that stuff. And for the banks, it was just a great time, whereas we were, you know, scared, stuck in our houses. The banks are now going to start feeling the pressure of what happened during the pandemic because the Fed raising rates so high means liquidity dries up for them and their whole environment changes completely. So if the banks put themselves in a position where they were set up for rates to stay low forever, for the good times, their good times, of the pandemic to continue, then they'll be running into a problem now because, as we've all experienced, the world has changed significantly and the economy has changed significantly. And so that is the struggle that banks face. It is a bank-by-bank situation whether or not they are prepared for this transition, whether they were prepared.
And why is this more a regional bank problem than a larger bank problem? Weren't all the banks interested in investing in bonds and you know, also were subjected to these higher interest rates, which made them less valuable?
Our big banks are subject to stress tests and capital requirements from Dodd-Frank that smaller regional banks are not subject to. So we kind of have a better handle on what they're holding and how much capital they have to cover any trouble that they get into. Also, regional banks are holding a lot of commercial real estate, which, as we know, you know, we're not really going to the office the way we used to.
Right.
So we kind of have to figure out what those assets, what they cost, or what they're priced at right now. And a lot of these smaller banks also went into longer duration. I don't want to go and explain this and bore your whole audience. But what I'm saying is that I don't want to.
They're
do
different.
That,
they're more at risk when these things
they're
happen.
More at risk.
I get
yes.
that. And then one in particular yes. is at risk that we've been talking about lately, and that's First Republic, based in San Francisco. Is it like Silicon Valley Bank in that it was exposed to a lot of tech money and therefore perhaps more at risk?
There are two sides to this. One is the deposit flight because you're exposed to tech money. It's a small community, and they were all telling each other, take your money out. One of my favorite columnists says that this wasn't so much of a bank run, of an idiot bank run, of a more of a bank run by idiots. Maybe I just said that wrong. But so everybody in Silicon Valley convinced each other that the whole world was on fire. So
yeah.
First Republic was very subject to that. And on the other side of it, what they did with the deposits they had was they put it into long-dated mortgage-backed securities. And so those assets declined as rates went up, because as rates go up, the value of the bonds that you're holding goes down.
Isn't that a lesson we were supposed to have learned from 2008? Mortgage-backed securities.
Any security or in this environment, you have to be ready. Like I said, you know, some of these banks were not positioned for the Fed to raise rates. They were mm-hmm. positioned for the world to stay the way it was, and First Republic was positioned for the world to stay the way it was. And so, a lot of what it was holding declined in value rapidly. A lot of his depositors fled, and that put in the bank in a very weak position. So is every regional bank like that? No. The other regional banks are not as susceptible to runs from Silicon Valley VCs who think the world is ending. And not all regional banks put all their money into, you know, long-dated mortgage-backed securities that were declining when interest rates went up.
Right.
So it's really going to be a question of management and controls and talent and intellect, how these banks are run, and we got to go bank by bank and check it out. That's
all
the
right.
work of the market, but do I think it's the whole system that is screwed? No.
Okay, well, that's reassuring, so thank you.
Yeah, I mean, just trying to keep it real.
Lynette Lopez, columnist, keeping it real, at Business Insider. Lynette, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, speaking of keeping it real, I'm going to keep it real right now with you guys. And that is, you support KCRW. Without you, there is no KCRW, and that is real. We are a public radio station. We're not a private radio station. Public means you. And so we come to you a couple times during the year to ask you, remind you to support us and support your public radio station. This is one of those times. This is day one of our spring pledge drive. And guess what? We have a special, special deal today. You can give any amount, and we will get an extra $100. So that is something that is a challenge grant, thanks to our board member, Silas Myers. So let's say you give $80, we'll get $180. So that's just today. This is a really great way to make your dollars go much, much further. And guess what? Everyone who donates this pledge drive, everyone who donates gets a special, extra special gift in the mail. So you can go get your premium. We have really great new swag at the website, kcrw.com. And we're going to send you a KCRW motel keychain. It's so cool. Vintage inspired, limited edition item. Even if you don't have keys to put on it, you just want to have it anyway. It's a cool little item. Anyway, so this is designed by us, and it will be yours once you go online at kcrw.com/join. Please give now. Get us that extra $100 for whatever amount that you donate, and pick yourself up some fancy swag on the way to doing that. So thank you so much for supporting us. I really appreciate it. It's kcrw.com/join. Coming up, the Sklar brothers will be here to talk about last night's mind-blowing World Baseball Classic. They'll also talk about how well UCLA men and women are doing in the NCAA. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
Okay, it's certainly no Vin Scully, but here's the call on Japanese TV last night, the moment Japan beat the U.S. in the World Baseball Classic.
Otani ka, Trout ka.
It is March, after all, and appropriate given that, yeah, we are right in the middle of men's and women's college basketball tournaments. Here with us now are the Madcap Sklar brothers, Randy and Jason, hosts of the podcast View from the Cheap Seats. Hi, you guys.
Madcap.
Madcap's great. It is madness in the sports world right now in a great way. From last night, that World Baseball Classic Championship game was incredible.
I know. And it just sounds like sports broadcasting abroad is just better. I don't know. It's just more exciting.
The emotion. There's nothing reserved in that. And the night, the game before, Japan came back against
Mexico
mm-hmm. with a 3-run home run by a player, Morikawa, who had not hit that well throughout the entire series. And he hits a 3-run home run. The call, I would say, go listen to the call of that, because that is even more exciting than what you just heard. And Japan went undefeated in the entire, they won their whole pool play. They went undefeated, obviously.
They have the number one player in the world who
Let's get to that in just a sec, but give us some context for people who don't follow baseball. What is the World Baseball Classic?
World Baseball Classic happens every couple of years, started in 2009, I believe. And it is this opportunity for, it's almost like I would describe it as kind of like the World Cup.
But for baseball.
But it meets the NCAA tournament in some way. But it's set up like the World Cup because
there's a group stage.
Group stage, you play in a group of four teams. And the top two teams advance then to the knockout rounds where it's you lose, you're out. So it's, you can kind of be 3-1, like the USA went 3-1. They lost to Mexico. Mexico was 4-0. They surprised the United States team in their group play, but both the United States and Mexico moved on. And so you can make a mistake in the opening in the group stage, but once you get to the knockout round, it's so exciting.
And that was yesterday with Japan, right?
Was the finals,
and it was an incredible, it's interesting, like we're trying to figure out why did the USA lose. Well, Japan has just an amazing team with, like Jay said, the best player in the world, Shohei Ohtani, who plays for the Los Angeles Angels
of Anaheim
of California. I think they're just continuing to add names to that, but he's the most amazing player. For people who don't know, he hits and he's like a tremendous power hitter. And he pitches. He's like an incredible pitcher.
They wanted him on the mound in the ninth inning to close out the game. And he closed out the game against his fellow teammate, Mike Trout, who plays also for the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, California, Southern State. Let's keep adding names.
Golden USA, State, the world.
USA, part of this.
But region. No, that was the a universe. Huge showdown. The fact that Japan said, we want to put the ball in this guy's hand on the mound tells you how significant he is. I mean, he's like this tall, statuesque, good-looking man, a guy who's really changing the way the world sees baseball and in many ways bringing the world up to the level of the United States and the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico, who have dominated this sport for years.
Okay, so, but they're teammates during the regular season. Right.
Yeah.
So he strikes out Mike Trout, and yet they have to go back to the locker room soon and be.
Yeah, they got to be friends. And believe me, Mike Trout is happy that Shohei Ohtani is on his team. And, you know, the interesting thing about Mike Trout is he had a real opportunity here to rewrite the narrative of this guy. I mean, people compare Mike Trout to names like Joe DiMaggio in the all-time greats.
Willie Mays.
You'll say about Mike Trout, he's a fantastic fielder. He's got incredible speed. He hits the ball really well. You know, he's making hundreds of millions of dollars playing for the Angels, but he's only been in the playoffs once in 2014, and they lost all three games he was in. So he has no, unlike a player in football like Tom Brady, who's won seven Super Bowls, this guy has lost all the postseason games he's had. So I'm not saying that this World Baseball Classic could have rewritten his narrative. However, with Mike Trout standing there in the ninth, bottom of the ninth, two outs against arguably one of the best pitchers in the game, in his teammate Shohei Ohtani, if he hits a home run, he changes the way people think about him. He moves the needle a tiny bit, and he struck out, which is not good for Mike Trout.
Right. Okay, so hanging over all of this is that Shohei Ohtani becomes a free agent at the end of this season, and so he may just flee the Angels of Anaheim, of Los Angeles, of the world.
Yeah, of the world. That would be bad for the Los Angeles Anaheim Angels of Southern California in the house. That would be bad because you now have two pieces, and Shohei Ohtani, this is just to tell you how much of a player and how great of a player he is. I always look to sort of former players, Hall of Fame players, how they view the young players. After the game, Pedro Martinez, who is Hall of Fame pitcher for the Boston Red Sox, one of the greatest pitchers of all time, and a great voice in terms of baseball. And he's kind of got old school, but he also respects the new school. He stopped the broadcast while Shohei Ohtani was there and said, and stopped everything and said, "I want to thank you for what you've done for baseball, for me, for all the fans, for everything." He did not say that to Mike Trout. He did not say that to Aaron Judge, who hit all those home runs last year. He said it to Shohei Ohtani. He said, "You're a special man." And I think if anything, Los Angeles, the Angels need to hold on to this guy as best as they can. Although there is fear in the back of your mind. You're like, oh, he's going to the Yankees. Like it's preordained.
Yeah. Or the Dodgers
even. Oh. You never know.
Okay, well, that's okay then.
That would be bad. That would be good for
as long as he doesn't go to the Yankees. That's okay.
That's
okay.
Right.
Let's go to college basketball and talk about the UCLA men's team. They take on Gonzaga tomorrow night. And do you think they could take the whole thing? Gonzaga's pretty good.
Well, they've looked great so far. They have senior leadership. They've got guys who've been here before. They've been in this tournament. They've made deep runs. If they can get past Gonzaga, which is a big ask, that's a tough team to get by. Then they will probably face Arkansas, although UConn's been playing well too. If they can get through this side of the bracket, they don't have to face a tough team, I don't think, until the finals, until they face perhaps overall number one seed Alabama. Again, like, this tournament has been so unpredictable. You have Princeton in the Sweet 16 for the first time ever. The first time an Ivy League school has won two games in this tournament.
And can I just say it's nice for those Princeton kids to finally have something go their way. I mean, most Princeton kids, nothing goes their way. It's just nice to see that they finally got
a win in their lives.
Right.
Another New Jersey commuter school, Fairleigh Dickinson, is also in it.
Well, Fairleigh Dickinson,
they lost,
but they won that first round game, which they beat Purdue.
It was a number one seed or number 16 seed, the lowest possible seed beating a number one seed, which a few years ago felt like it was an impossibility. And then it happened to the University of Virginia. They were number one seed. They lost to a 16 seed. So if you're a Purdue fan and you're feeling down, the very next year, Virginia came back and won the whole tournament.
But Purdue, the tournament before, lost to a 15 seed, St. Peter's, who made a deep run. So Princeton, a 15 seed, is now in the Sweet 16. Their coach, this is interesting, Princeton's coach, he was on the last Princeton team to win a tournament game. They only won their first round game in 1996. They knocked off UCLA. And so they're
defending champion
UCLA, because they won it all in 1995. So if you're looking at the men's bracket, I think UCLA has a shot because there aren't a lot of big number one teams left. Kansas lost, Purdue lost.
And probably the weakest number one team, Houston, that has struggled in this tournament to continue to advance, that's on their side of the bracket.
We have to get to the women. UCLA women take on South Carolina on Saturday.
I mean,
so can they take the whole thing?
No,
South Carolina is defending champion, right?
They're just dominant.
South Carolina is 34-0, and typically in women's basketball, the number one team, and it's been been UConn for years and years, and UConn's still in it. That's the team that usually wins it all. So my money is on, I'm not betting, but my figurative money is on South Carolina to win. UCLA's had a great year. I'm going to tell you one player to look out for in the tournament. She plays for Iowa, and they're a number two seed. They're still in the tournament. Caitlin Clark. She's maybe my favorite player on both the men's or the women's side. Watch her in this tournament. She's amazing. She's electric.
Ooh, okay. Randy and Jason Sklar Brothers, check out their sports podcast, View from the Cheap Seats. You guys, thank you. And we are going to spend a minute fundraising. Do you want to say anything to
Let's
our audience
do it.
about what they should do?
So, of course, we love KCRW so much. We participate and do what we do on this network because we love it so much. We're avid listeners. I mean, we love Madeline. We love this show. Everybody, what you guys don't see as well are the scores of people, the sound editors, the producers, and all those other people who, I can tell you, they give their all to this to make
that
this program
100%. That is
so good. So they're the on-air people, but they're the people behind the scenes who are incredible.
Who we know, who prepare us for these segments and prepare Madeline, and they're
Boy,
amazing.
Do I need
so do
to
it for them.
For these segments.
Yes, oh, you did great. You're wonderful, and wow. It is a joy to do it. So we say give because this is a tremendous organization, not just from the voices you hear, but from the people behind it. And, you know, look, we're going to give. That offer that you were talking about, the fact that you could give $20 and it's $120 today.
I know.
Today,
it's like free
incredible.
Money. Free Let's money in this
we're
day
We're getting
age.
Off the air. We're going to get off the air and give right now.
Yep. All right, good. Do it. 800-600-5279-KCRW.com/give. Be like the Sklars and be supporters of your public radio station, KCRW. This is our spring pledge drive. We really need you right now. We need you to get in on the ground floor the first day. And as Randy said, $100, an extra $100 we get. So give whatever you need, give whatever you can. But the important thing to do is to just get in on it at kcrw.com/join. Coming up, why is it that the black character in horror movies like The Shining never gets to live?
Danny and his mother are able to escape at the end. So he does provide a means for escape, even though he doesn't himself physically, you know, save the day.
A new book explores the role of black characters in horror movies. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Apparently, a whole bunch of brothers been missing in this suburb.
Couldn't see no brother around here.
Get out!
Yo!
There's too many white people. I get nervous.
The movie Get Out was a triumph for a specific genre of filmmaking, black horror. Jordan Peele won an Oscar for his screenplay, and the film marked a high point for a half century of scary movies featuring black actors. But horror films as a whole are ripe with conventional tropes. There's the final girl, you know, the last girl left standing. There's the evil doll or clown. And there is the black character who is usually the first to die. Robin Armines Coleman is a vice president and DEI officer at Northwestern University who studies the intersection of media and black culture. And Mark H. Harris is a longtime entertainment journalist who created the website blackhorrormovies.com. And they have teamed up to write a new book called The Black Guy Dies First, Black Horror Cinema, From Fodder to Oscar. Welcome to both of you, Robin and Mark.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you both. That is a great title. I like how it kind of rhymes at the end, Fodder to Oscar, but The Black Guy Dies First is really eye-catching. How often, Mark, does the black guy die first?
Well, you know, I think that's kind of the name of the trope, and it's kind of a funny way to kind of put it. But the black guy, you know, or girl might die second, third, fourth, might even die last, but, you know.
But he always dies.
Well, you know, it doesn't always, but yeah, there's a really good chance
that he's going to die.
Robin, why does a black guy die all the time?
So to bring a little bit of seriousness to this, to what is a really fun and funny book, often the black guy dies in service or support to whiteness. And so that is the black annihilation means that often in these horror movies that also feature a diverse cast, a predominantly white cast, it means that white people get to live on and see another day. So often these black characters are quite sacrificial.
Well, I want to get to one that I'm thinking of a little later on when you make that point, and that is Scatman Carruthers in The Shining. But we're going to save that and get to that in a bit. First, I want to go to 1968 and a movie called Spider Baby. Here's a clip.
Anybody home? Please say yes, somebody's home.
Caught a big fat bug right in my spider web. And now the spider gets to give the bug a big sting.
Ooh, okay. Mark, what's happening there?
Well, the quote-unquote black guy in this movie is Mantan Moreland, who's a longtime actor in a lot of black and white movies from the 30s and 40s. So in this movie, he's kind of the epitome of the black guy dying first. He plays a messenger who goes to this creepy house, and he's kind of trying to deliver his message and do his job. And he sticks his head through the window, and he is snipped with some shears by a crazed white woman who's part of this weird cannibalistic inbred family. And it's really, you know, we started out the book with this movie because it really is the epitome of the black guy dying first, and it's really kind of a reflection of the way that black characters, you know, have historically been treated in horror. They're kind of disposable, and they're there to kind of just increase the body count. So this is really one of the pioneering examples of that.
Right. And Robin, expand on that. This is happening in a particularly important time period in American political life. It's 1968. So, you know, right during the civil rights movement and all sorts of upheaval happening in society. How does this movie fit in with that?
Yeah, Spider Baby is interesting because of the ways in which it presents not just black and white relationships, but the relationships between black men and white women. And so within that context, it's not just 68, but it emerges as along a long trajectory of blackness as unworthy or even monstrous, and white womanhood as being sort of complex, whether it's a King Kong where the monster is sort of metaphorically black and the white woman is held up. But there's a violence that comes through these interactions between black men and white women, and Spider Baby illustrates that the best.
Right. So you mentioned that the sacrificial, you say there's a trope called the sacrificial Negro. And so now we can talk about Dick Halloran, played by Scatman Carruthers in The Shining. He is the savior of the white characters, Danny and Wendy, from Jack Nicholson's character. He goes up in his, what is it?
The snow cat.
The snow cat, that's it. The snow cat. And he comes upon an axe-wielding Jack Nicholson. Here's a clip.
Hello? Anybody here?
Yikes. Okay, that makes me scared just hearing that. So he's getting axed in the chest by Jack Nicholson, and then Danny's allowed to escape into the hedge maze, and we know the ending. So, Mark, tell us about this character and why he both embodies and cuts against a stereotype.
Well, he's a couple different things. His character is typical of a lot of these roles in that his life revolves around this white family. He is there basically to just worry about the little boy basically and his well-being. And so he's kind of, when he leaves and he goes to Florida or wherever it is, he can't even rest. He's like sitting in his bed, just kind of basically waiting to be activated into sacrificial Negro mode to come save this family. So he kind of, you know, gets a sense using his magical Negro powers. He kind of comes across country, goes through all this trouble and ends up there. And, you know, you think, oh, he's going to kind of help save the day. And he's chopped down, you know, within minutes of arriving. But on the other hand, you could say, even though he does die, he does in some way save the day in that he does bring the snow cat. And the snow cat is the way in which Danny and his mother are able to escape at the end. So he does provide a means for escape, even though he doesn't himself physically, you know, save the day.
But in the book, he lives, right? He doesn't die. So Stanley Kubrick killed him off?
Yeah, and I think we talk about it a little bit in the book in that Kubrick was, I think, asked about it. And he said, you know, they just needed something to, you know, establish the danger of the situation. And the character was basically the only expendable character. So, you know, and that's really typical of what we talk about in the book is that the black characters are seen as the expendable ones. They're the ancillary characters, the sidekicks. And so they, in horror movies, they are the ones who typically face the axe.
Hmm. Robin, can you talk about why these characters have to be black? I mean, there can be sacrificial characters who aren't black, but why do they have to be black in so many of these movies?
I think it's sort of interesting because it happens both within and outside of horror. So The Legend of Bagger Vance, The Green Mile, The Shining, there's a long history in cinema of seeing this kind of sacrifice where, you know, you see this also in sort of like voodoo and zombie films where there is something about black people who are still continued to be in support and succor and service to white characters, to whiteness. So that translates to celluloid, where there's that same expectation or fantasy about a day gone past.
And Robin, you mentioned this idea of spirituality and mysticism, and there's a really interesting part in your book where you talk about how the entire genre of the zombie movie is drawn from Caribbean religious traditions. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Drawn from, but also exploited. And so on the whole, religiosity is set up as other, as exotic, as dangerous, as evil.
And scary.
And scary. And the scariness is a threat to whiteness.
Right, right. So talk about Night of the Living Dead, also made in 1968. And this is George Romero's classic. The lead in this film is black, played by an actor named Dwayne Jones. And he is actually the last man standing after zombies overrun a farmhouse and an armed posse arrives. Here's a clip.
Let's go check out the house, man.
There's something there. I heard a noise.
All right, Vince, hit him in the head, right between the eyes. Good shot. Okay, he's dead. Let's go get him. That's another one for the fire.
Okay, so a lot to unpack there. And talk about this character and how he is the lead of the film. But he has to die. But he does die last.
Yeah, it's a really striking ending. This black character is, you know, the lead, and he takes charge of this white group who is trying to survive this zombie onslaught. And, you know, he's ordering people around, he's bossing them around, and he's organizing things. And, you know, one by one, they get picked off, and he's the last man standing, only to have himself shot and killed by, for lack of a better word, a lynch mob that is hunting zombies. And the implication is they mistake him for a zombie, but, you know, there's definitely a racial overtone to the imagery. And so it's really something that's striking even to this day. You know, George Romero claims he didn't intend any sort of racial connotation in the movie. The character of Ben wasn't written as black, but I think that it really is food for thought, especially coming in an age when, you know, Martin Luther King was assassinated in the same year. So it's something that really resonates still today.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that he cast a black actor and the part wasn't written for a black character. So why did he do that?
So the story has evolved over time about the casting of Dwayne Jones, and it generally gets bigger and bigger about how much he leans into the narrative that this is colorblind casting. And it may have been, but I'm sort of arguing that that's less important as the ways in which we make meaning of Dwayne Jones as Ben on the screen. And Dwayne Jones as a black man, as a black actor, brings with him his blackness, right? And blackness's relationship to whiteness. And so whether it's colorblind casting, once he's on the screen, that is a black man. That's a black man, as Mark often says, who slaps white people around, who shoots a white man. It's a black man who is in that sort of small farmhouse kicking ass and taking names. We read him as such. We understand his relationship to those people as a black person, perhaps in a white space.
So it really changes the movie then for you. Like, if it had been a white actor, would you have read the movie differently?
Absolutely. I think we all would have read the movie differently because we hadn't really seen. This is 1968. And so while black people have been showing up, been parachuted into horror films since the 1890s, we really hadn't seen a starring role in a generally white horror film, right? Where the black guy is the star and you've got this white cast. That was novel. And we read that within the context of the civil rights movement. And certainly we read that in the context of what we know happens with Romero the night he's trying to get distribution for the film. He talks very powerfully about having the film cans for Night of the Living Dead in his car, driving to New York for distribution when he hears it on the radio that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. has been assassinated. And we all have to wonder in that moment, does he now know how incredibly more powerful this film has become?
Wow, that is really fascinating. So speaking of real life, you end the book talking about a horror movie that from real life, a real scene, and I'm talking about January 6th. Can you describe how you see that as almost a scene from a classic horror movie?
For me, I thought it was World War Z.
Yeah, I mean, the throng of people were really, you know, it really evoked images of zombie movies where people have been driven crazy with rage and you know, are irrational and are just teeming over each other, just nothing getting in their way. And it really was interesting seeing that the lone figure standing in their way was this black police officer. And given the headlines, you know, in recent years of black people's, you know, history with encounters with police officers, it was an interesting reversal. You know, the black person is the police officer and the civilians are white and they're, you know, threatening to overwhelm him. And he really struck a heroic figure in that image, you know, something that evokes, you know, images of black horror movies, you know, a black lone figure against a sea of whiteness that has bad intentions towards him.
Yeah, I mean, you have people actually in costume with these crazy antlers on their heads and
yes,
wearing animal skins and face paint. I mean, it looks like something out of a horror movie.
Yeah.
And then he is acting as the savior in a way too, saving the senators, some senators, and directing them away from the mob. It's really incredible.
Yeah. I would contrast that with the images we saw in Charlottesville, which looked so much like The Purge. There's a way now that the images that are coming out of the reel look so much like what was at one point we thought so horrifying but fantastical. So I love the connection between that you've picked up that we're trying to illustrate between the real and the horrifying. Both illustrate a danger and a trauma, particularly for black people, but also a monstrosity. And the hero, in sort of a Dwayne Jones-esque kind of way, is standing lone at the door, really now protecting our democracy.
Wow. Officer Eugene Goodman. Well, this is a great place to end, but I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. Fascinating book called The Black Guy Dies First, Black Horror Cinema from Fodder to Oscar by Robin Armines Coleman and Mark H. Harris. Thank you both so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. You are listening to KCRW during our spring pledge drive. I'm just going to take a minute or so to ask you to go online at kcrw.com/join and become a member. And I have a very special guest with me now to help. Hello, Steve Chiotakis.
Hello, Madeline Brandt. How are you?
I am well. How are you feeling on this first day?
I feel good. I feel empowered, and I'm going to tell you why. I'm looking at this free limited edition keychain if you make any donation at the website.
Yeah.
Have you seen this thing?
Right? It's so cool.
The
it's
diamond
like a retro
shaped one. Yeah, it's like a plastic diamond
keychain.
Shaped one.
Yeah.
And I've spent a lot of time in. I'm not going to say that. So, anyway, but the keychains are very nice. And they said, no, that was a joke. Always on LA. It's got the KCRW big transmitter tower and the little zapping coming out of it. It's really cool. You'll want to see it. Go to the website, kcrw.com/give, and you will for any donation. And, you know, why is it important? The conversation you just had, Night of the Living Dead was terrifying to me the first time I saw it.
Yeah,
right? So, I mean, and so many good points made.
And so is January 6th.
And
so,
yeah, well, it's terrifying to the country. But anyway, we digress.
But this is what KCRW does. We bring you culture stories. We bring you news stories. We bring you music. We bring you everything all wrapped up together. You don't have to go anywhere else. And this is the only station in the country that does it the way we do it. So that is something worth supporting. It is real. We are not a chat bot. This is not a mega corporation. This is your local public radio station.
Yeah.
And we need your support at kcrw.com/give.
Yes.
Coming up, Evan Kleinman is here to tell you how to have your pie for dinner and dessert all in one meal, so don't go anywhere. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lunch?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, Queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bit like that.
Pie.
Not just pie. Pies. Plural. Pies with an S. We're going to talk about two of them with Evan Kleinman, the queen of all pies. Also, she's host of KCRW's Good Food. Hi.
Hi.
All right, very excited. We're going to talk sweet and savory, beginning with savory. And you have brought us a savory pie recipe that calls for Swiss chard. Tell us more.
So I chose to feature this Swiss chard pie that is actually baked in a slab. So it's perfect if you're going to have a lot of company. If the recipe is too big for you, you're not having company, just go ahead and make the same amount and then use the extra dough and the extra filling to make ham pies that you throw in the freezer.
Oh, can you make the whole thing and like cut half of it and make it, put that in the freezer, or do they have to be little?
No, I guess you can. I'm just not a big person who freezes stuff that's already finished, but yeah. I know a lot of people do that. So I will say yes.
Okay. Tell us what goes into the Swiss chard pie.
So the chard cooks along with some onion, garlic, spices, and a little bit of white wine. And then you add some sour cream for richness and to kind of temper the bitterness of the green. You could add feta if you wanted something a bit more assertive. And then you cook the stems first, since they take a bit longer. And then you add the leaves along with their moisture from being washed to cook down.
Sounds good. Why Swiss chard over, say, kale or spinach or any other green?
I actually think Swiss chard is one of the mildest of all of the dark leafy greens. And then for me, it's also heavily about the stems. I will often cook the stems separately in a different way than the leaves, just to have a two for one.
But in this recipe, you're putting it all together and then you're binding it with some kind of dairy.
Yeah, you're binding it with a little dairy. It's still pretty loose. It doesn't have any flour in it, no egg. So what holds it together is the crust. And the crust is kind of awesome because it has black pepper in it.
Mm.
Just that little touch makes it something just a bit special and different.
If you had to, could you use the same crust for your sweet and your savory pie?
You know what? We love spice. So, sure, why not?
I mean, I was thinking the other way around. Like, you could have a sweet crust with your savory filling.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you and I have both declared to one another our slavish adoration of crust.
I know. If I could just eat the crust, I would be a happy person.
Yeah, I'm one of those people who would be happy just having a huge hunk of crust and dipping it into the filling.
Yeah.
But yeah, even with greens like this, you could even use a dough recipe that was a tad sweet, because that will just be beautiful with the greens.
Yeah, no, that's what I was thinking. Like the bitter greens, the sweet crust.
Mm. You're such a creative.
Can you do the crust in advance?
And then you should do the crust in advance. And you should do the filling in advance, because the last thing you want to do is take a hot filling and throw it on, you know, your very cold pastry dough and ruin it. And then the day you're going to eat it, you know, then you can roll out the dough, fill it, and bake it.
So that's all you do. You call this a slab pie. You just roll it into a slab.
Instead of using a pie pan, you just shape it on a sheet pan, a little sheet pan.
And then that's dinner. Or that's have that as a side?
No, no, no. That's dinner. I would serve it with a salad made of a tender lettuce, maybe like butter lettuce, mm-hmm. but with a very sharp kind of vinaigrette, like maybe with a mustard shallot garlic vinaigrette, or maybe an anchovy garlic red wine vinaigrette.
Mm, that all sounds delicious. All right, moving on to dessert. You have brought us a rhubarb raspberry pie. Tell us more.
I am not a huge fan of the texture of strawberries once they've cooked inside of a pie, but I love the way that they make the rhubarb filling redder, but raspberries do that even more. Raspberries tint the red of the rhubarb so much redder, and the thing about rhubarb that I love is it cooks relatively quickly, which is good. And it's really easy. You just cut the rhubarb across into like 1-inch pieces. I usually start with about 3/4 cup of sugar for about 3 to 4 cups of sliced rhubarb. And if it still tastes a little too tart, I'll add like another 1/4 cup of sugar. And I mix that up really well before I add the raspberries, because you don't want to crush them completely. And then you just add a little bit of starch. I prefer cornstarch for this one, but you could use flour. Throw it in the dough and top it with a lattice or a full top crust or even a crumble topping and bake.
Mm. And it doesn't get too syrupy?
As the sugar and the juices of the pie ingredients heat up, the sugar completely melts, it turns to a liquid, and then it binds with whatever the starch that you've put in there. And the secret is not to eat a pie straight out of the oven. You need to let it cool down so that whatever starch you've used can gel. And that takes a little bit, maybe an hour or so.
Okay, so patience, patience, patience. It's hard to have patience when all that deliciousness is in front of you.
Yes, because every bit of runny filling that's on the plate is a lost opportunity for your mouth.
Words to live by. Okay, what's on Good Food this week?
On Good Food, we have a wonderful segment with the gentleman who performs in drag as Bertha the Pie Queen. She is quite wonderful. And then I talked to the women behind the coffee shop's Sip and Saunder. And then we learn about dry aging fish with the owner of a fish place in the valley called The Joint, the only fishmonger in town who dry ages fish.
Evan Kleinman, host of KSLB's Good Food. You can listen Saturday mornings at 10 or wherever you get your podcasts. Evan, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
All right, this is the end of our meal, and it has been a full meal on Press Play today. We've talked about interest rates and what that means for the economy and for you. We've talked about sports with the fantastic Sklar brothers. We talked about a really interesting book called The Black Guy Dies First about black characters in horror movies and what that says about our culture. And we had dessert with Evan Kleiman and talking about pies. This is a full service radio station you have on your hands here. People come here for the news, the culture, and also, of course, the music, which is unparalleled. So that deserves your support, right? KCRW.com/give. This is day one of our spring pledge drive, and this is how it works. We come to you a couple times during the year, and we ask you to support us. That's how it works. It's very simple. We can't do it without you. And today is a very special day because we get even more if you donate today. So no matter how much you donate, each donation will unlock a $100 bonus. So let's say you give $80, we'll get $180. And that's thanks to our board member, Silas Meyer. So don't wait for our $100 extra. KCRW.com/give. Lots of people have donated already. I want to thank someone named Brandon Stewart who says, saludos from Coventry, UK. He's calling from the UK. Even though we're separated by 8 hours, I still get my daily music and press play fix from KCRW. So if he can do it from England, you can do it from anywhere. KCRW.com/give. I'm Madeline Brand. Thank you so much. I'll see you tomorrow.